It was the dawn of the third age of podcasting, 12 years after the B5 premiere. The Babylon podcast was a dream given form, its goal to discuss Babylon 5 episodes, arcs, and implications, to interview the cast and crew about their experiences and memories. It's a home away from home for fanboys, geek girls, and lurkers. It can be a silly place, but it's our last best hope for B5 fans. This is the podcast about the story of the last of the Babylon stations. The year is 2006. The name of this show is the Babylon Podcast.
And welcome back to another Babylon Podcast. I am Summer Brooks.
I'm Tim Callender.
Hey there, it's Jeffrey Willard calling from the center of the universe, Los Angeles.
Hollywood. Sorry.
How are you guys doing? Happy 4th of July to both of you.
You know what?
Thank you.
Yeah, it was a good one. It was a good one. Saw family that don't normally get to see too often, and that was a lot of fun.
I got to take a nap.
I had a rare treat myself, Summer. I drank.
Why am I not surprised?
Hey, but I got to tell you that the best part of the weekend, the holiday for me, and probably for Tim, and probably for you, Summer, and probably for a lot of other people, was the beautiful and successful launch of the space shuttle.
Yes, that was fun.
Awesome. Yeah. So it's for that reason that I have a very special... Now, did you see my thing? I now have qualified certain guests on our show as, what did I call them? EQFs?
Extreme mm-hmm. fan guests?
Extremely qualified fans.
Yes.
I think that should be a new special, like you get a badge of honor or something like that, or maybe there's a handshake you got to know, but to be an EQF, an extremely qualified fan to get onto this show... We've had Muir on before, right? We had mm-hmm. Muir on before, and we had Sandy on, right?
Yeah.
Both of them I call EQFs. Tonight, I'm going to introduce you to Louise Kleba, another EQF, and you'll find out why. Let's go to the phone.
Okay.
Hello?
Louise.
Yes.
Louise, it's Jeffrey.
How are you?
I'm good, dear. How are you?
I am still walking in clouds.
Are you awake at all, or are you
yeah,
awake at
bedtime? I'm kind of in a zombieville, but that's okay. It's a happy zombieville.
It's a happy zombieville. Wow. So do you have some time to speak with us now?
Sure.
Ah, terrific. Well, Louise Kleba, I want you to meet Tim Summer and Summer Brooks. Tim Summer. Tim Callender and Summer Brooks.
Now, who's in the Zombieville? That's what I want to know. Hi, I'm Tim, Louise.
Hi, and I'm Summer.
Hello, Tim and Summer. I'm Louise.
Okay, well, we did that introduction really, really good, kids. So let's move on to our first couple of questions. Louise, for the listeners out there, Louise, your title is you're a payload engineer at Kennedy Space Center. What is that?
My responsibility is to follow any of the hardware that goes into the payload bay that the astronauts would use in space, whether it's the multi-purpose logistics module or any of the carriers that would have something like last mission, they had the control moment gyro. This mission, they have the tile repair payload. So I follow it in its day-to-day operations through the flow here at Kennedy Space Center.
So when you talk about being in a happy cloud, Louise, that means that you're thrilled with the success of the launch of Discovery so far.
Oh, yes. It was stunning. We were out there at the roadblock and watched it launch. And, of course, I always told myself that when it was no longer a thrill for me, it was time for me to leave. And I found out that it's still a thrill. I still cried like a baby and jumped for joy when everything went right.
Yes, that's great. So today had to be a very big day for you then, because today is when did they actually do walks today?
No, they didn't. Today was the day that they took the extended boom section that they attached to the shuttle arm and did an inspection of the leading edges of their wings and other surfaces of the shuttle to see if there was any severe shuttle tile damage or damage to the surfaces from any potential foam or other impacts.
And
like
what's the verdict?
Oh, well, to be truly honest, I haven't heard the news tonight, but I haven't heard any big alarms going off at work or anything. I haven't heard any discussions of anything significant. So
okay,
that's just more happy news.
Yeah.
More happy news. Okay, so now for the listeners who are scratching their heads at this point going, okay, this is very cool. We got a rocket scientist on the show here. What does this have to do with Babylon 5? Let me try to explain that. There was an ongoing program between the Babylon 5 production and several members of different organizations within NASA to always try to do our best to make sure that we, on the show, were getting the science as right as possible so that we were applying plausible theories or utilizing new technologies and, in some cases, actually importing some of those technologies and resources directly into the show. For example, we had a tight relation with the people at the Hubble Space Telescope, who would provide us imagery from the Hubble, and in some cases we were the very first public people to even see this data, and we would use those that imagery as backgrounds for the star Furies and the station to fly through and stuff like that. This relationship that we had with NASA kind of went two ways, because in many ways the Babylon 5 production team was always in total awe of the NASA guys, because they were the real deal. And yet, we also found out that the NASA people were just in awe of everything we were doing on the TV show, because they found it to be inspirational.
Huh.
That is sort of how Louise and I got to be friends, was during the Babylon 5 days. Isn't that true, Louise?
That is very true.
Go ahead.
We had this small group of people, particularly at the Kennedy Space Center, avid fans of the show, just truly drawn to the realism that you spoke of, the fact that, you know, you could see the real thing happening. We had, you know, little things that things make noise in space and stuff like that, but, you know, it's Hollywood. We had to forgive you on that aspect, but we had a group of people who, being avid fans and having access at that time through various sources to next week's episode of Babylon 5, would call a code 7R, and if fans of the show will know what that is. We'd call a code 7R and send out an email with a cryptic room number and a time embedded in it, and that was our lunch hour. We would sit and watch next week's episode because we were just too anxious not to wait until Friday night.
Now, did anyone at NASA EarthGov ever catch on to what a code 7R was?
If they did and they were fans of the show, they probably joined us surreptitiously. If they didn't know what it is, it sounds official enough that we probably got away with it.
And I seem to recall you also made a trip to the stage, didn't you? You came out to the stages.
I did, several times. I escorted some of the astronauts who were fans of the show, of course, and also met a number of the actors and production personnel at conventions at which I would speak as a guest. So It was a multi situational circle that really drew us into it. And I think my first exposure to Babylon 5 was actually at a convention I did in Phoenix that Joe Straczynski was a guest and was selling a show that didn't have a name. And I freaked out when I heard all about it, and I told him where I worked, and if there was anything I could do to help, he needed to let me know. And he looked at me like I belonged in a rubber room with one of those funny jackets that ties behind your back. But, you know, eventually we had face-to-face, and he probably didn't think I was totally off the wall. So, but that was, I was actually a fan of the show before it was a show.
Wow.
Yeah.
Takes me back to Genie days, and the coordinates of the station for true fans are the Genie coordinates that we used to all meet and, forgive me, I'm tired, battle on with JMS about the show. So,
were you, as a youngster, were you a science fiction fan first, and that's what got you interested in this career that you've got now, or was it sort of the other way around? Were you someone who was always interested in the sciences, and then growing up you discovered the magic of science fiction?
Oh, did you read my biography or something? actually, it was the latter. I had no clue that something called science fiction existed until I got to eighth grade. And what is that? I think that's 12 years old.
Eighth grade would be about...
Something in that area.
Yeah.
Since I had decided I wanted to go to the moon when I was 3,
mm-hmm.
That pretty much meant that I spent 8 to 10 years without knowledge of this thing called science fiction. And in eighth grade, I had an instructor, a teacher, who wanted us to choose between 3 books, or amongst 3 books, one of them being a Shakespeare play I'd already read when I was 5, another one being just totally boring to me, but something along the lines, and I apologize to your listeners who might be fans of such stuff, but I just wasn't into the bodice-ripping romance type stuff, you know, Gone with the Wind, whatever. And the third selection was a book by Isaac Asimov called Pebbles in the Sky.
Uh-huh.
And I picked that only because it was the one thing I hadn't read or had more interest in. And I was fascinated. So after that, I thought Isaac Asimov was the only science fiction writer, so he was the only one I read for a couple of years. But I think by the time I hit my 20s, it became evident that there was a wider audience and also a broader subject matter, even within the science fiction realm, and I became familiar with a lot of it. And, of course, I was a Star Trek fan when it hit the airwaves. So. One of the original Lincoln Enterprises members.
Oh,
I'm sorry?
Wow.
Yeah.
I was going to ask if you ever
had
the opportunity
my card around here somewhere.
To meet Isaac Asimov.
Yes, I did. I did actually get to meet him. I believe we were at a convention in New Orleans. It was either New Orleans or Boston. It's kind of long ago. But I was young enough to still have a rump round enough that he pinched it in the elevator.
I would still pinch your butt, Louise. Absolutely. You didn't have to ask me twice.
You'll need two hands these days.
Now, Louise, being a Trek fan, I'm sure you're aware that there are a number of scientists and like-minded people who were influenced by Star Trek growing up to pursue careers in engineering and science and that sort of thing. Have you run into anyone yet who's been influenced by Babylon 5 to pursue a career?
Actually, several young people that I've met at conventions and such. I'm probably not seeing so much because any of the people who I've run into at some of the conventions either have already established a career and an interest, or they haven't quite got out of high school yet. So.
Right.
They haven't, you know, they are inspired to go on, but they haven't quite gotten to the place where they've made that decision to move into the sciences. But I do meet a lot of co-op students that if I'm wearing one of my Babylon 5 shirts to work on Fridays, which is our dress down day, and I do that, I will get like, oh my God, that was an awesome show. So I know that they're out there. And so it's good to run into them still.
Looking at the differences in the starscapes between what we saw in Babylon 5 and what was shown in Crusade, does that reflect advances in astronomy?
I would say that it does, only because as we all are aware, the sciences continue to evolve, and they improve their hardware that they're using to take images or to, you know, study the sky. All of that is always improving, and everybody always has a better mousetrap. So even when you have the best of technology in anything, before you get it home and out of the box, it's already obsolete. And I think even amongst the astronomers and the scientific instruments that they're using, you probably would have the same response or the same phenomenon going on, because it just does evolve. And another thing that's interesting, and probably some of your listeners would be aware, even when you do have that technology, you can look at the same picture using a different technique, and it'll look like two different images.
Sure.
Say that you're seeing one in white light and another one in infrared.
Right, or X-ray.
In a gamma or something.
Yeah.
It's the same source, but it looks so phenomenally different in a different spectrum that it looks like it's totally different.
Yeah, think of like radio astronomy, the images that that produces compared to, you know, normal light or what we can perceive through our eyes. Absolutely.
Well, right, what we see with our own eyes, kind of thing. That's exactly that type of situation is exactly what I'm alluding to, because our eyes are limited by a very narrow spectrum. And we have so many tools now available to us that are able to see in so many different types of light, ultraviolet, infrared.
So, what are some examples of items that the production team came to you with? Hey, check this out. Is this going to work scientifically?
I believe that we're seeing a lot of items that are actually coming the other way. Things that were developed or used on the show are being seen more readily in the science community. It's more like fiction becomes reality rather than, you know, reality going back to fiction, because the one wonderful thing about things like Babylon 5 is that they were looking so far ahead, it gave us something to reach for, to strive toward. And so you see a lot more of their technologies, even though a lot of it was probably fake, coming into reality. And you see that in our new firing room technologies. You see that a lot of times in some of the upgrades, probably even in the shuttle, just technologies that you see in everyday life. One, I think, of the things that, well, actually, I'm having one of those senior moments, and I had a wonderful example, and it just went away. You know, that zombie brain is dripping.
Hey, let me ask you this. I was just having the same moment. Louise, you, in the time that we've known each other, you've had a couple of different roles through the various programs. I seem to recall, and this is my senior moment here, did you, when we first met, were you working in the astronaut training programs? Did you used to train them, like a mission training role?
Actually, I've never been in the training role. However, what you're probably remembering is that I am what they call a flight crew representative. So I'm assuming a lot of your audience is Babylon 5 fans.
Oh, yeah.
And
Both of them are.
Both of them are? Okay. Well, then here's another one. You're interviewing another one. If I make the comment that I am a ranger for the astronaut corps,
there you go.
I think most of your folks would pick up on it.
Gotcha.
Okay. Now there
I'm
was
the eyes, the ears, and the voice.
There was another part where you, I seem to recall you were involved in a huge international coordination process where elements were coming together for the space station from the different countries, and you had to kind of go around and bitch slap a lot of countries to make sure that they got their stuff to us on time. Is that about right?
Can we put that a nicer way?
You had to use the power of the Rangers to bring them into line. How about that?
Yeah, that's exactly it. You know, I just got out that old pike and pounded a couple.
There you go.
Here's Drew the line with the pike and tell them don't cross it here. Well, I did some international travel. We had exposure in that aspect to a lot of different cultures, not only culturally, you know, as people, but also corporate cultures. So we're Americans used to a government corporate structure going into private industry, not only U.S., but international, and dealing both with their multicultural aspects from theirs, because the Europeans, of course, have representatives from many different countries working in their program. And it's just this hodgepodge. It's amazing to us every time we launch one of these things or see the station fly overhead at the right opportunities, that I'm completely amazed that this international cooperation, whether we had to spit and scream across the table or not, that it comes together and it works. And that's what's so emboldening about it, because Babylon 5 was very much the same way. You had so many cultures, you had so many people, and you had to find a way to cooperate and to live together. And it really was more representative of what we had to deal with on a daily basis. And the inspiration to us was that you could make it work. And too bad it didn't happen in a one-hour program, but, you know... It took us 16 years, but I mean, you know, but it was still, the underlying belief was that we could still make it. And when we see the station fly overhead, we're continuously reminded that in this aspect, it has worked. So,
can I do I have to admit something here, and this is the first time I'm admitting it publicly. Talk about how Summer gets her geek on. This is how I get my geek on. Do you know that I watch? There are a couple of websites where you can monitor the tracking of station. I have the 3D software that monitors 500 different satellites in real time, and all that. So I'm telling you, I'm so over the top. And every time the space station flies over Los Angeles, I am outside in my backyard staring at the sky watching it go by, and I wave every time.
Wow.
That's awesome.
Okay, now that's not a secret. Patty's going to have a fit that I told you that. But
the horrible secret has been revealed.
I'm out
now. Here's a magic moment. I remember particularly after we had just started, the first two elements of the station were on orbit. It was rather small yet, and there was a night landing. Well, you may or may not know that the shuttle has absolutely no lights. So, you know, it's coming down in the dark, it's black. There's no possible way you'll see this thing, but everybody in my neighborhood runs outside, even on a starlit night, to wait for it to come home. And this particular night, we went outside about the time that it was supposed to come overhead, and we were listening for the sonic boom, and it's a double sonic boom, and it was just, it was a clear night, absolutely windless or anything else, so the sonic booms shook everything in the area. But immediately when we heard the two booms, and they're rapid, they're boom, boom, you hear them, the space station was flying overhead.
Wow.
At the exact moment. And here we were just on the threshold of putting the two pieces together, and the guys were returning home, and the shuttle, or the station, was flying overhead at the same moment that they hit those sonic booms. And I knelt down and wept in the lawn. I'm sure my neighbors thought that I had a seizure or something. But the thing was, it was just like we made it a reality. You know, it just... That was my magic moment. So I cheer you for running outside and looking through a Los Angeles sky looking for it.
Well, the last time it landed out here at Edwards was in the middle of the night, and like a good boy, I had my alarm set, so at 4 o'clock in the morning I was outside waiting for it to come down. And I have to tell you, it was most interesting because I really anticipated sort of seeing somewhat of a streak go across the sky. And that's not at all what happens. It was a it appeared as a star in the sky that just got brighter and brighter and brighter and brighter and brighter, and really didn't transverse the skyline at all. And that's when it dawned on me, this thing is just like a brick falling straight down on Southern California rather than scooting across the sky. It just like falls straight down.
Yes, it has all the glide characteristics of a brick. You named it right away.
Right.
It's like 21 degrees straight toward the ground.
Unbelievable.
That's got to be a hell of a ride.
Yes. I'll let you know. I'm supposed to, it's not something that might happen, so maybe I'll wait for another opportunity to tell you about it. No, I don't get to fly in the real shuttle. Don't worry about it.
Oh,
Louise, you brought let's see, you brought Marsha Ivins to the set. I remember that, right?
Yes,
Rich.
Janet Boss.
Janet, yes, right.
And of course, there's a couple of active astronauts I probably can't name, but they made their trip there too. And,
you can't name them? Why? Are they be drummed out of the core for
the 5 weeks? it has to do with that commercial ventures or whatever. And I realize B5 is off the air, but, you know.
Right.
It's still,
can't,
you know.
Yeah. I got you. That's what a bummer.
So, but they're out there. You've got a huge fan base in the crew, amongst the crew members. In fact, Jerry Doyle, Mr. Garibaldi, had announced that he was coming in for this last launch because he happened to be friends with the pilot in this flight and was an invited guest with Mark Kelly and his family.
Wow.
So that happens quite frequently. Jerry happened to be visiting the Kennedy Space Center with his then wife, and they got to meet the entire corps. So at one time, he had met all 96 of them or whatever it was. He found his fan base amongst them and gets invited to the launches when they're launching, which I hope is far more frequently now. And you'll have to come down and join us.
I'd love to. Absolutely would love to.
Well, I've had that standing ovation, standing invitation for, excuse me, I slipped back into reality there.
yeah, we posted it on the board at the Babylon, at the Babylon set, I remember.
Yeah, I know. It's 10 years you've been asking me to come down there, and it's just never worked out. Yeah, I know.
I know. One of these days.
Jeff, you want to just have to work on a documentary about the about NASA.
Sure. Sure. Who wants to be an astronaut? I could do a new reality show.
Me.
There you go. I think they'll send you to the space camp.
Yeah, there
the
we go.
The astronaut experience.
I'm
and,
thinking
now we have, that, we have that wonderful zero gravity flight, you know, commercial flights now. So
yeah.
It's called zero gravity.
Louise, what's your feeling about Spaceship One and what Burt Rutan did?
Actually, my personal feeling is that while I'm thrilled that he demonstrated the concept for rapidly turning around and flying again, I was severely disappointed that he didn't turn around 2 weeks later and do it again. Because as far as I'm concerned, anybody can try twice. But he hasn't made a continuous effort for it. And that's my personal disappointment. Because to me, it doesn't really demonstrate that we've got a pure commercial capability. However, then I understand Mr. Branson got into it, so we may see more. And I am aware of other companies who are pursuing something along the same lines. So we will hear probably more from them later this year.
What other scientific, I guess it says here, Jeff says that you were responsible for keeping the science on the show accurate. Do you recall any specific corrections, like waving of the flag saying, no, 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 you can't do this, you have to do it this way?
Well, actually, thank you for picking up my senior moment and planning it back in my brain. There was a bizarre moment. I happened to be working a landing, and I had just gotten back to my desk, and I was clearing things up and getting ready, you know, to exit for the day, and I got a phone call from Flip Senior Moment into this spot. The gentleman's name escapes me. But he told me that they were going to be filming the final episode and that they needed to find out how fire reacts in space. And it was as if it was planned on cue. The astronaut who actually did the experiment about how fire acts in space walked in and was standing at my desk to talk to me.
Wow.
So looking at him and holding this phone in my hand and going, hang on a minute, I got somebody who can tell you exactly how that happened. And I handed the phone to the astronaut and I explained to him very quickly who it was and why he was calling. And he picked up the phone, and they made arrangements to speak at length at a later time. And I realized when I saw the episode that just, of course, tore out all of our hearts, when they blew up the station, I went, oh, my God, I'm responsible because I gave him the phone. So that was my contribution to getting it right.
Were there ever any moments when you were sitting there watching it and they just got it wrong, you know, outside of the you know, sound in space, but it just something that was just so head-slappingly bad that you just, cringed watching it?
Well, there wasn't any cringing. It was more like, oh, man, I wish we could do that. But our absolute favorite vehicle, of course, was the Star Fury.
Mm-hmm.
And in many cases, you manage to do things really good because, you know, the wings would pivot around and the guy would be facing the back and keep going forward, but, you know, translating along a different vector, if I may use those words.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd go, oh, that's cool. But then he would shoot off at 90 degrees and we'd all just go squish. Because that won't happen. and you can tell if you watch any of the shuttle coverage kind of thing, when they're about to fire the thrusters, everybody will gather things up if they're loose, because as soon as the thrusters fire, you'll see astronauts and everything else shift right or left or up or down depending on which way the thrusters were fired. And because, at least in that environment, you are in a perpetual falling, if the vehicle goes a different direction, you're still falling, so you don't go that direction until you bounce into something.
Right.
And to make such violent changes in direction, even in zero gravity, physics still works. Everything has to go in that direction, you know. And so that, and it wasn't enough for us to say, ooh, woo. It's like, oh, wow, wouldn't that be cool if you could do that?
Hey, and just for the record, we happen to have our finger on the pulse so well at Babylon 5 about what was real in science. I just want you both to know that in the future, there will be sound in space.
Well, actually, if you have your hand on the thing, you will hear sounds coming through that, but not traveling through space itself. So,
yeah,
so there,
you say that now.
Yeah,
I don't know, Louis.
Kind of
we had a listener who said that if it's in color and it's on TV, it must be true.
Oh, man, that really makes me feel bad. I took my baby sister to see Fantasia when it was re-released, and of course they did the anniversary release with The Son of Flubber, which came out at the same time.
Oh, man.
And if you remember, you probably are way too young to remember that they have double features.
No.
And they had Fantasia, and I'm bringing her into the theater, and oh man, I remember when this first came out, and Flubber came on, and oh, we all wanted Flubber. And she looks at me as the movie starts, and I'm telling her that, you know, I remember when this first came out, and she looks at me and she says, loud enough for everybody in the theater to hear, you paid to see a black and white movie?
Oh man.
Okay, now I'm 22 and I'm crawling under my feet. I never felt so old until that day.
Right, so Louise, one of my last questions is kind of important. Who is it that you would say was your, favorite character?
Gosh, let me think about it.
Oh, man.
Boy, my favorite character. Well...
Oh, this is easy, really.
Yeah, it is. You know, it's a four-letter word, and I just have to spit it out, you know?
I'm having
that senior moment. Was it Kiss? No, that's the guy with the weird makeup. You know, gosh.
There you go.
Gosh.
What a stretch. That's so great. There's an extra little five.
Actually, all of them were. Like, it wouldn't have been a show without everybody, and I love them all. So, And I love all the people that made it happen. So just add them to the team.
Well, thank you.
And
so
you all
much.
Belong to our team, too.
Yay.
Yeah, well, thank you.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
We're just trying to keep the flame alive.
Good. Pass that torch.
We will.
Congratulations to you and to all of NASA for another spectacular flight.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
We're looking forward to a good, safe landing, too.
Mm-hmm.
And many more to come.
That would be fantastic. We would all be good with that.
Yeah. Thank you, guys.
Thank you, Louise. And we will be back with more Babylon Podcast right after this.
Hi, it's Brian Richardson from DragonCon TV. People have brought you such wonderful productions as Stormtroopers Gone Wild. Can't wait for DragonCon to come around again? Well, stop by DragonConTV.com and relive some of our funnier moments. Well, they're funny in my opinion anyway. Stay tuned also for the debut of our new videos at DragonCon 2006. And now, we return you to your regularly scheduled audio program.
And now it's time for our wonderful, wonderful listener feedback section. Tim, how many voicemails do we have?
We had actually a fair number, and I think what we'll end up doing is kind of distribute them across a couple weeks.
Okay.
We've got two tonight, and we've got a fair amount of email. And actually, I think since the last time we whined about not having people send us stuff, we've been getting a fair amount of stuff in.
Great.
Do
you want to do the emails first or the voicemails?
Let's do some emails first.
Okay.
What do you say? Okay, this one comes from Matt in Michigan. This is his comments on signs and portents. Excuse me. First off, I would really like to hear Summer say, "Whoa, that is cool again," because it pretty much sums up my reaction to the episode, too. Summer's just a fan favorite. What can we say? I really don't have much to add.
Wait, make her say it.
Okay. All right, hang on. Whoa, that is cool.
Give Matt his wish. Come on.
There you go.
Yeah. All right. Well, I think we're done for tonight.
Matt's in the shower.
Yeah, right. Anyways, Matt continues. He says, "I do have a question that's bothered me ever since I first saw the episode. Garibaldi passes on to Sinclair that Kosh requested some parts to repair his encounter suit because it was damaged during the attack on the station. Regardless of how it was damaged, and an entire other topic of conversation, why did he ask for parts? As secretive as Kosh and the Vorlons are, why would he ask for parts from humans? It might reveal some information about the suit. Also, why go to humans at all? What on Earth, or Babylon 5, would they have that he would need for his encounter suit? He has a ship in the docking bay that should have things he might need. It's an organic ship. It could conceivably grow anything he might need for his suit. From a meta perspective, I know it's just a method to tell us Kosh was in a serious fight, but it seems a weak way to do it."
I have a theory on that.
All right, go ahead. Because it's bothered me, too. It did seem fairly gratuitous to me as well. But go ahead. You enlighten us.
Kosh is the future Doyle Brunson, a hell of a bluffer. He's playing a hand that he's already won, only everybody else doesn't know it yet. So he's feeding them the information he wants them to have.
Fair enough.
Okay.
And I think that makes sense. Yeah. How about you, Jeffrey? What's your feeling? Have you been
Matt,
on the inside of the suit?
Yeah. I have two theories, Matt. And both of them I'm not married to either one of these. The first is I think Swiss Army knife was what he was after because they're just cool.
Oh.
And every man race needs to have a Swiss Army knife. But I think probably knowing Kosh as well as I do, I'm thinking one word, Matt. Corkscrew. Kosh found himself a little Merlot and just could not get it into his system fast enough. And all the advancements in the universe just couldn't make that cork come out of there.
Well, you know, I can live with that. You know why? Remember how Jakar once said that every sentient race had this perfect food, and on, you know, the earthers called it Swedish meatballs?
Right.
There's this perfect tool called a Swiss Army knife, and
yes,
the Vorlon didn't have one at that moment.
Which just only goes to show how ill-prepared he was to come aboard the station, because next to not having a towel, I can't think of anything else you should not be without.
Thanks, Matt. You can see we take our stuff really seriously here.
All right, another email. This comes from Pavel Stuchlik, or Stuchlik. I am destroying that, I'm sure. I'm sorry, Pavel. He says, greetings, Tim, Summer, and Jeff. Jerry Doyle is not the only Babylon 5 cast member on radio. Bill Mumy has a radio station on Live 365, Bill Mumy Radio, that plays more than 7 hours of his music, plus some stuff he co-wrote, including a few songs from Claudia Christian. If you haven't heard it yet, then this is the place. Go to www.live365.com/stations/307836. And I do understand that Bill is more interested these days in pursuing music than acting. Is that true, Jeffrey?
Absolutely. In fact, he has a new CD coming out, which I'm scanning emails right now. Wait a minute. Here it is right here. Bill Mumy and Band. He's got a CD release party night. Saturday the 8th at Rusty's Surf Ranch at the Santa Monica Pier. I know you're all there. Come on down. But he doesn't announce what the name of the CD is. So, yes, Bill is an outstanding musician. His band has... You know what's very fun about watching him and his band is they're just fun. These guys have so much fun because it's not their career. So they don't go over the top. They just have a great time. And if there's ever an opportunity for you to see Bill Mumy and his band play, do so. It's way worth the effort.
Did you ever sit in with them?
Have I sat in with them?
Yeah.
No. You mean like to play?
Yeah.
Yeah.
No. For the same reasons that you don't ever want to see me in front of camera again for the betterment of society, let's not be putting me up on the stage. No, let's not do that. Bad idea.
All right, our next email comes from Mike Tuck. I thought I would try to clear up some confusion about the comics. I have all of the B5 comic books that were published, to my knowledge. I've never heard of the four-issue miniseries that you guys were talking about unless you were talking about the individual story arcs in the comics. There was a regular monthly series that was published by DC in 1995. It was a standard page count comic, but it must have gotten bad sales because it only lasted 11 issues. I remember Sinclair being featured prominently in at least the first few issues. In 1998, DC tried again with Babylon 5 in Valen's name, a three-issue miniseries, which had better artwork, if I remember right. Says, I think it involved Delenn and some of the others finding out about Valen's past through a computer on a satellite that was falling out of orbit toward a planet. They had to work fast and escape it, but I'm not 100% sure of that. It would take a monumental task for me to dig out those issues because I have a huge collection of comics dating back over 20 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, again, it's all foggy for me, but I know that I have, like, the complete collection, too. And I haven't seen it in years. It's in a storage facility. But from everything he says, that rings true for me. I think that was the case, and I do recall, Sinclair being the first part of those. Yeah, I think he's spot on. I think he's spot on. Okay.
You have a huge collection of comics you have to dig through, Jeff?
Yeah. What did he say? 20 years. Yeah, well, mine's 30 years. No. In fact, I'm pretty sure the only comics I even have are the Babylon 5 comics. So.
It's all about quality, not quantity.
There you go.
All right. Rob Batters from Brentwood, UK, says he just listened to show 22. You should know that Jeremy Clarkson is a motoring journalist of some note in the UK. He has a weekly TV show in which he drives all the latest, greatest supercars flat out. And to think that Kosh might just be in the passenger seat in a Mojave Desert special.
Wow.
So, see, now, Jeffrey wouldn't say much about what he was doing out there in the desert, but I suspect they were doing land speed trials. We have Jeremy Clarkson driving something fast, I'm sure. We have, flying saucers from Area 51. And I imagine Jeffrey brought along the Vorlon special to completely show them all up.
Yeah. Yeah, we had a good time out there. Did I tell you that I got arrested for being on the Air Force base?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you did.
Yeah, okay. Well, that was just a highlight. I just thought that was, you know, I like to always just point the spotlight directly at my flaws and get them out of the way right up front.
So there was no driving flat out across the desert.
Well, I'm glad he knows and can tell the American audience who Jeremy Clarkson is, because as he said, he's a known entity, a significant celebrity in the UK and actually in many countries around the world. So, thanks for setting the record straight and making sure that everybody knew I wasn't just a loony.
No, you're a loony with connections.
Thank you. Be here all week. Try the salmon.
Why don't we go ahead and go and roll a couple voicemails at this point?
Okay.
Hello, Tim. Greetings, Summer. And cold showers to you, Jeffrey. This is James in Dallas again. As I said in my last voicemail, I'm glad y'all are making the Babylon podcast. I'm so glad that, like I did for Slice of Sci-Fi, I've made a donation to help support this podcast. Michael, if you're listening to this, I hate to disappoint you, but I only have time to listen to two of the Farpoint Media podcasts. Anyway, for others that haven't made a contribution, join those of us who have, so you too can brag about it. After all, it's never too late for the pebbles to gloat.
I have no idea what that means, but okay.
That's Mike.
That was great.
That's awesome.
I would tune in every week just to hear whoever that was.
Now.
Yeah.
What? I'm trying to figure out what he donated.
That's what I'm trying to figure out as well.
Hey, donations are good no matter what. You know, it's
absolutely.
Keep them coming in.
We have to give him appropriate props and thanks.
Sure.
Well, we've had a couple people donate script books to the Babylon podcast. And
well, just to help keep that straight in the future, if you are out there and want to make a donation, it's JeffReY.
No, that's the Draco Vista Studios in Phoenix, Arizona.
Wow. Okay, Tim, you can rock us with that one.
Just continue to give.
Yes.
And give often.
This is Jonathan in Dallas. Jeez, Tim. I'm amazed you made it past the first season of B5. It doesn't seem like you like any of the one-off storyline episodes. Actually, I'm amazed B5 made it past the first season at all. JMS had to create an entire season that communicated the universe and the people that inhabited it. And that's actually what I really liked about it. And you can see that in, like, the Parliament of Dreams shows us the, you know, each race's religions, and Believers shows us how they view other alien races. And in Signs and Portents, you get that what do they want, you know, what are their racial goals. And through it all, there's a clear message in episodes like In the Sky Full of Stars, Deathwalker, Survivors, The War Prayer, By Any Means Necessary, and even in Eyes, that there is something wrong going on at home. JMS had to include all of this, building the episodes for the future, but with a way to keep the audience. And I think that the one-offs were his and possibly an inevitable solution to that. Anyway, it just seemed to me that we kind of had to have the first season populated with these one-off episodes so that you could plant the seeds and reap the rewards later on down the show. But anyway, love the podcast. Thanks, guys.
All right, Jonathan, you're absolutely right. I hate them all. Summer, can we just go straight to Coming of Shadows next week?
Tim?
No.
Tim?
Yes?
Tim, you just got spanked, dude. Jonathan in Texas totally kicked your butt. He's telling it like it is. There you go. I've been meaning it. At least he's got the balls to say it. I have to be nice to you every week.
You do?
Wow.
I'll look at that part of the contract. well, you know, what can I say? He's right. No. All right. Do I get a chance to defend myself, however weakly that might be?
By all means.
Okay, that's about it. We're out of time, right, Summer?
I understand why the one-offs are there, and certainly going back through the first year, again, I personally am seeing many more connections that play out later on in not only the first year, but certainly the second and third years. But having said that, one of the reasons that I managed to get through the first year is knowing that there was going to be this five-year arc. It's more evident, obviously, in episodes like Signs and Portents, Babylon Squared, I think Soul Hunter. But having said that, I think that the one-offs, while they're necessary to establish the universe, generally aren't as strong as the arc episodes, if you will. Well, you know, and I'll admit, part of it is, at the time especially, it was my own impatience. You know, I mean, the one-offs were nice to establish what was going on, but I'm chomping at the bit going, all right, you know, give me the big story. I'm ready for that. So that's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
All righty, then.
But I don't think I'll sit down for a week now. Thanks, Jonathan.
All right, guys. I've done some checking through the Farpoint Media donation archives, and I've run across your donation that was given to you from John. Would you like to know what it is?
Sure.
He made three individual donations. One of $20, another of $20, and one of $10.
Sweet.
Wow.
So you can scrap over who's going to get the $10.
Well, that's Jeffrey, obviously.
I'm not exactly sure why.
Any of the alcohol.
I'm not exactly sure why he split it up as 20, 20, and 10, but... I don't see any names on that, so I guess you can speculate on who he likes least.
Wow.
Well, thank you.
Well, everyone loves Summer, so it's obviously we got to, you know, fight between Jeff and I.
Yeah, I was thinking it was 40 for Summer, and Tim and I had to split the 10.
You never know. It might be that. There's really no directions
matter,
on
it
the...
It might be all 50 for Summer, and Jeffrey and I are standing there...
Well, yeah, actually, coming from Mike, I don't trust him as far as I can throw him, so it was probably 20, 20, and 20, except he already scammed 10 off.
I wouldn't do that.
Yeah, he does have to buy the tequila that you drink when you're here, Jeff.
Yes, I know, and I come there so often.
Yeah. Good thing too. The last bottle cost me $300.
Yeah, well, I didn't tell you to buy that.
Don't you know Jeffrey's easy with whatever?
Yeah, I'm sitting here drinking $9 tequila, and I'm having a good time. So.
Oh my god, you got the mezcal? Does it have a worm?
It's something new. I don't even know what it is, but I was like $9, and it has
just
a cork. Hell yeah,
the agave plant. That's all.
Well,
he's got an agave out in his front yard. He pulls the leaves off, sucks on it occasionally. And
in any event, thank you very much, John. We do appreciate it.
Remember the intro to the show. It can be a silly place.
It can be a very silly place.
We can redefine funny and silly. And
okay.
Let's
wrap that show out.
I don't think we could top the silliness factor anymore. So,
are we done yet?
We are done.
Can we blow up the space station now?
No, we can't blow it up. We have a long, long way to go before we get there. But
I'm rolling the music. You guys got to go.
If you want to send us an email, that email address is babylonpodcast@gmail.com. Or if you want to contribute a voicemail message to us, that is 206-338-2259. That number again is 206-338-2259.
The year the Great War came upon us all.
And we will see you next time on the other side of the gate.
The preceding program is part of the Farpoint Media family of podcasts. To find out more about Farpoint Media and the many other podcasts available, visit www.farpointmedia.net. A world of audio wonder awaits you there.